From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Be a freedom fighter in the 21st century is to make a radical distinction between hope and optimism. One must be a prisoner of hope. Yes.
Cornel West, professor, activist, theologian, author.
A blues people have so much to teach a blues nation that the doings and sufferings and visions of black people in the Jacobian manner have much to teach the United States now that as a nation we have the blues.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley. The BBC said yesterday Dr. David Kelly, the British weapons expert who committed suicide last week, according to the government, was the source for a report on doctoring intelligence files that led to a battle between the BBC and Prime Minister Tony Blair. The announcement by BBC's director of news cast doubt on the network's credibility, says the government, because Dr. Kelly had told a parliamentary committee 2 days before his death that he did not believe he provided the report's central contention that the government had sexed up a government intelligence dossier by incorporating a claim that Saddam Hussein had chemical and biological weapons that could be deployed in 45 minutes. According to the New York Times, the announcement further undermined the authority of the hotly contested report in that Dr. Kelly, a former UN weapons inspector in Iraq and an advisor to the Ministry of Defense, was not a senior intelligence official involved in preparing the dossier, as the network had called its anonymous source. A U.S. soldier and his Iraqi interpreter were killed this morning in a grenade attack north of Baghdad. On Sunday, the two other U.S. soldiers were killed, as was an Iraqi employee of a U.N.-affiliated relief agency. Meanwhile, the U.S. announced plans to train a new 7,000-strong Iraqi militia within the next 45 days to help police Iraq. In related news, U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan has called on the U.S.-led forces in Iraq to set out a, quote, clear timetable for a staged withdrawal from Iraq. For the first time, a top U.S. official has admitted that the U.S. deliberately stepped up raids over Iraq last year to prepare for this year's invasion. Publicly, the U.S. claimed its pilots were simply enforcing the no-fly zones, but officials now admit the strikes targeted Iraq's fiber-optic military communication system, as well as the military's key command centers. The secret plan, codenamed Operation Southern Focus, was launched last summer before President Bush even took his case against Iraq to the United Nations. Lieutenant General Michael Molesley told the New York Times U.S. forces dropped some 600 precision-guided bombs on about 400 targets in the months leading up to the actual invasion of Iraq. But the report further strengthens the assertion the U.S. invasion of Iraq did not begin in March, but quietly during the summer of 2002. Time magazine reports Michael Powell, the chair of the Federal Communications Commission, has told friends he'd like to leave the FCC by fall. The FCC has come under tremendous criticism for ramming through new regulations that rewrite the nation's media ownership laws. Last week, a House committee voted 40-25 to reverse part of the FCC's decision. A recent poll by Pew Research found 90% of the country opposed the changes, which were lobbied for by big media corporations, including Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. FCC head Michael Powell is the son of Secretary of State General Colin Powell. For the first time, evidence has emerged that North Korea may have secretly built a second nuclear plant for producing weapons-grade plutonium. This, according to a report in the New York Times, quoting unnamed American and Asian sources. Meanwhile, U.S. News and World Report says Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld recently ordered U.S. military commanders to draw up new highly classified plans to deal with North Korea. Named Operations Plan 5030, critics of the plan say it is so aggressive that it could provoke war with North Korea. The U.S. has temporarily suspended plans to try two British prisoners and an Australian held at Guantanamo Bay in a secret U.S. military tribunal. Officials from the three countries are expected to meet this week. This was one of the requests of British Prime Minister Tony Blair when he came to the United States last week. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz this weekend visited the Iraqi town of Hilla, where mass graves have been unearthed containing over 3,000 bodies of people killed 12 years ago, it is believed, by Saddam Hussein. Wolfowitz said, quote, obviously, for those liberation did not come in time, he went on to describe the killers of villagers as monsters. Meanwhile, the total number of Iraqi civilians killed during the U.S. invasion of Iraq has now topped at least 6,000. This, according to the website IraqBodyCount.net. And those are some of the headlines. And you are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting today from Berkeley, Pacifica Station KPFA, where Pacifica is celebrating the return of the Pacifica Foundation to its home in Berkeley. Also celebrating the new general manager of KPFA, Gus Newport, and the terrific reign of Jim Bennett, the outgoing general manager of KPFA. Well, today, dozens of Justice Department employees have been accused of serious civil rights and civil liberties violations of Muslim and Arab immigrants involving enforcement of the Patriot Act. The findings are part of a new report by internal investigators at the Justice Department that was released to Congress last week and raised new concern over whether the Justice Department can police itself. The report is awaiting public release. Dr. West is a professor at Princeton University. He was speaking recently in Santa Fe in an event sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. Special thanks to Thunder Road Productions, who recorded Dr. West's speech.
For me, one of the great moments of American culture actually occurred in August of 1955. Very few people want to talk about it. In 1955, of course, Emmett Till was murdered by fellow citizens, victim of U.S. terrorism. The body thrown in the Yazoo River, the Tallahatchie Bridge, under the Tallahatchie Bridge. But his body was brought back to Chicago. And the first major civil rights demonstration took place. 125,000 fellow citizens walked by to take a look at Emmett Till. His mother left the coffin open so they could see. It's a Pilgrim Baptist Church led by the Reverend Julius Caesar Austin.
Can he introduce Mom's Teal Mabley? And she walked to the lectern.
She looked over at her baby, whose head was five times the size of his normal head. And she looked in the eyes of America as well as the folk on at Southside Chicago, and she said, "What? I don't have a minute to hate. I'm going to pursue justice for the rest of my life." That's a level of spiritual maturity and moral maturity that does not give up on the Socratic attempt to interrogate the mendacity and hypocrisy of American life, but is rooted in something deep. It's rooted in an attempt to keep track of the humanity of the very people who have dehumanized you. Use that as a standard of responding to terrorism in light of the last 2.5 years. My God, how fascinating.
Here's Moms Mabley speaking on her behalf and speaking for the best of the tradition. Martin King's in the background. Fannie Lou Hamer's voice is there. A. Philip Randolph's voice is there. And many nameless and anonymous black leaders who knew they had to deal with a situation in which they were unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated for who they were. That's what it meant to be a nigger. Unsafe, unprotected, subject to unjustified violence. And hated. Now, after September 11th, all Americans feel unsafe, unprotected, subject to random violence, and hated. You say, now that the whole nation's been niggerized, let's see what the response is gonna be.
Interesting.
I come from a tradition that says, in the face of terrorism, it's justice, not sweet revenge, not short-term retaliation. It's justice. Hunt them down if they've committed a crime, yes. Demonize, no. And even within the black tradition, if there are black folk who demonize, they are criticized based on that tradition in light of their not aspiring to the standards of Emmett Till's mother. And if that's the case, that's certainly the case for George Bush and other leaders. Crucial, indispensable, bringing together the best of the legacy of Athens, the best of the legacy of Jerusalem, but in the New World context in which legacies of slavery, Jim Crow, police brutality, lynching, discrimination, redlining and bank loans, on and on and on. Always connecting one's vision about one's own freedom to the plight and predicament of others. Sisters of all colors, gay brothers, lesbian sisters, physically challenged brothers, indigenous brothers and sisters, so that they all constitute overlapping and intertwining traditions of struggle. But knowing that the courage to think critically and the courage to love, and I think we need to talk publicly about the courage to love. That's what I love about the best of the black freedom movement. You see, it's very rare that you find progressives. These are my dear white brothers and sisters speaking publicly about love. You say, why is that? Well, it's a longer story we won't go into. Just don't. Abraham Joshua Heschel did. Dorothy Day did. Early Michael Harrington did. The later Michael Harrington, who I worked with very closely, he had shifted from a certain Catholicism to a certain socialism, but was consistent across the board. And he was my comrade in both instances. He just changed his mind on some things. But
But James Baldwin talked about love explicitly as the most difficult, dangerous, but also the most significant force in the world. Why? Because if you come from a people who have been so hated, love can become subversive and transformative, beginning by loving yourself. Marcus Garvey talked about love explicitly. Yes, Elijah Muhammad didn't talk about loving white brothers and sisters, but that wasn't his only point. There's other people in the world other than white brothers and sisters. Now, he was immature to have to base the love of black people on devaluing white people, but he talked about black people loving themselves.
Mr. Louis Farrakhan the same way. Much progress and evolution necessary in terms of his building on Elijah in an early stage, yes, but he's talking about loving themselves. Why is that important?
Because it's a form of agency. It gives people a sense of confidence. And part of the problem of America is what? People don't feel like they have any agency. They don't feel that they're confident in making a difference at all. And especially in the States, where, my God, what was it in the election, the last election? 80% of white America thought the election was fair, and 80% of black America thought it was unfair. And somebody's right and wrong about this thing. I'm not a relativist at all. There's a fact about the matter.
32% of black people for the war.
Nearly 75% is white America for the war. There's a difference here. Agency makes a difference for people who are cutting against the grain in their perceptions. Love becomes a form of agency. And not only that, but it helps break down the barriers, the walls of demarcation. And so even when the black rage and the black fury, the righteous indignation of having to look white supremacy in the face in all of its dimensions and still persists, the language of love still allows white brothers and sisters to recognize that is not all of them, or is not genetic. The white brothers and sisters can make choices.
John Brown is part of the movement. Tom Hayden's part of the movement, because it's all about choices, decisions, commitments. No one is locked into a pigeonhole or some category.
So the love becomes crucial. Not only that, but of course, I believe that it's impossible to talk seriously about fundamentally transforming America or any other country, but especially America. It's impossible to do that without talking about forms of spirituality, and especially music. Spirituality is all about how do you deal with your constraints and limitations. And when you run up against that anange, those constraints and limitations, you're going to need something to fall back on, like a community that is sustained by levels of spirituality which have to do with contesting, which have to do with sharing, which have to do with sustaining persons so that they don't become short-term freedom fighters. Miles Horton, that great freedom fighter, 20th century, the white brother who founded Highlander Center with Rosa Parks and Stokely Carmichael and host of other freedom fighters would come out of Tennessee, move down to the South. He wrote a wonderful autobiography called The Long Haul. We need freedom fighters like Amy Goodman who are in it for the long haul. And that's hard to do. I know it's a lot of brothers and sisters from New York and Boston who made it out to Santa Fe trying to get a little distance from urban context. I can understand that.
But you bring that tradition with you, because even in Santa Fe,
the same struggles go on. Context a little different, bluer sky, okay. More beautiful mountains, yes, okay, I grant you that. No doubt. But you are the same moral, spiritual, politically committed human being here that you were in New York and D.C., Philadelphia, Chicago, wherever else you come, and meet those who have been here for a long time. brown brothers and sisters. Go back generation after generation after generation. Of course, our indigenous brothers and sisters, century after century after century.
Princeton University Professor Cornel West speaking in Santa Fe in June. We'll be back with him in a minute. John Coltrane, recorded live at the Village Vanguard. Here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, I'm Amy Goodman as we return to the speech of Princeton University Professor Cornel West, speaking this past June in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
We come now to our present moment. What do we see? A bleak moment. Let's be honest. One of the bleakest moments in the history of the civilization. America is now, it's not only an empire, but in scope, in depth, in power, it exceeds the British and the Roman empires. Nothing like it in the history of humankind. No countervailing force at all. The repressive and regimenting Soviet Empire went under 12 years ago. It was a countervailing force. It supported Mandela when he was a terrorist for 27 years. We like to remind Americans of that. But there's no countervailing force at all. And like most empires, it's arrogant, it's hubris, it feels as if it can shape the world in its own image. Dictate its terms in terms of what it wants to do.
And as my dear brother Noam Chomsky reminds us, not only put forward a new doctrine of preemptive strike, because that's a doctrine that says that if it looks as if someone's about to attack you, you attack them before they're able to. That's not what the new doctrine is. This doctrine says, if a nation has a set of elites who are contemplating possibly challenging the U.S. power, they are subject to attack. That's preventive war. That's a new norm in international relations. It's the law of the jungle. And it sends signs and signals.
Troops of 100 nations, bases in 70 nations, a major carrier in every ocean. Internally, 1% of the population owning 48% of net wealth, financial wealth, 5% own 70% of the wealth, and that's before the tax cut. And the result is what? As you can imagine, the most vulnerable. Beginning with who? The children. It's already 22% of all of America's children live in poverty, the richest nation in the history of the world. It's a disgrace. Disgrace. The children. It's 7% in Canada. It's 6% in Japan. It's 22% in America. 46.
2% of red children, 39% of brown children, 37% of black children. They are 100% of the future. Poverty educates. It shapes the way they look at the world. Gives them a sense of who they are, the untrustworthiness of existence. And here, the greatest empire in the history of the world has this plutocratic, oligarchic, to some degree still pigmentocratic, hierarchy in its economy. And then the most vulnerable, the children. And who are connected to those children? Poor women. Workers of both genders. Handicapped. Disproportionately black, brown, and red, yes, but numerically mainly. White brothers and sisters, where is the discourse? Where is the outrage? Where is the indignation? Or is it that the sleepwalking taking place has become so normative that we feel as if we can't make a difference? What is going on? Thank God again for our artists. When they get beyond the family dysfunctionality and vanilla suburbs, they can have broader canvases. Many do. The Lord, there's some dynamics going on the global scale. And we know what? No empire lasts forever. All empires come and go. They ebb and flow. Chickens do come home to roost. You're going to reap what you sow. Sooner or later, reality's going to come back on you. You can only live in a state of denial for so long. You can only hide and conceal your structures and institutions in place that don't at the present highlight the dilapidated school systems in chocolate cities, unavailable health care for 44 million fellow citizens. Difficulty regaining access to child care, especially given the welfare reform signed by a spineless Democrat named Bill Clinton. Playing political football with the lives of poor people to win the next election, trying to triangulate with the Republican Party. Ought to be ashamed of himself. Now, he's a friend of mine. I've told him this, so I'm not speaking behind his back. Told him this at the White House, why I didn't vote for him the second time. But I supported him when they tried to impeach the brother. I thought that was wrong. But just plain speech, frank speech, that's all. Just trying to tell the truth with love. In the spirit of self-criticism. But our moment is one in which what? Our media, about as unsocratic as one can imagine for the most part. Mainstream media. Oligopoly at the top. Journalists afraid to raise questions to the powers that be. Thank God for Pacifica and the other voices. Very important. We must support them. It's an indispensable service. Even in our universities, professors running scared. Afraid to speak out. A host of different issues. On the Middle East, can't even criticize the government's policies without being cast anti-Semitic. You say, wait a minute. Now you got the Israeli left engaging in such powerful critique of their government? If they can do it in Tel Aviv, how come you can't do it in Chicago, New York, and Santa Fe? Anti-Semitism is a vicious bigotry, form of bigotry. There's no doubt about that. But it can also be used to silence critics. We've seen a variety of different languages deployed to try to hide and conceal certain truths that ought to be highlighted. Black folk do it, white folk do it, women do it, Jews do it, Italians do it, Russians do it, across the board.
Do we have what it takes to exercise our parhesia? And to exercise phronesis, a practical wisdom rooted in a compassion, you see. And I don't believe it's just a matter of election to election. This past week, Supreme Court spoke 5-4. It was a very significant decision, very important. I didn't applaud, but I was slightly delighted. It was much better than I expected. And the reason I didn't applaud, of course, is because it just struck me still as so narrow that institutions of higher learning could have such long traditions of sons gaining access to these institutions, not always meeting high standards, but no debate. Geographical diversity, people from Idaho and Montana gaining access, not always meeting the highest standards, no debate whatsoever. Athletes gaining access to these slots, not always meeting the highest standards. No debate. Even when they are Ain't Haggard's children, black folk. But after 244 years of slavery, which was against the law for black people to learn how to read and write, Jim Crow, in which they paid, we paid taxes for public institutions of higher learning and couldn't even think of sending our children to those institutions almost a century. And finally getting a foothold and a toehold, and as soon as the black folks show up, you get a national debate about their deficiency and how rigorous the standards ought to be. That's a level of hypocrisy we ought to be honest about. We ought to be candid about that. And if they don't meet minimal qualifications, they don't belong. But how many meet minimal qualifications? My God, at Harvard, 9,000 do. They only got 1,800 slots. What are you going to do? Ted Kennedy met minimal qualifications barely and got in and took some Irish working class brother's slot who was brilliant and went to Boston College. Said this to Brother Kennedy too, so I'm not speaking behind his back. He knows he got in by legacy, son of, grandson of, brother of. When he showed up, was there a national debate broadcast around the world, every corner of the globe, about the deficiency of Irish rich folk? No. When George Bush showed up at Yale, was there a debate about rich wash? No. But no, let Jamal show up. Let Letitia show up. And the whole machinery kicks in. And all of a sudden, now everybody's so concerned about everybody having 780 on their board score above, or if not, we're going to sue you. And we should keep in mind that the three brothers, the three white fellow citizens who sued, they could have chosen white students who had board scores much lower too. They didn't. They chose the Negroes. What's going on? Hypocrisy. Let's be honest about it. So I was slightly delighted. You see, but some folk had a party and I stayed home and listened to Luther Vandross. God bless him. He just left the hospital. He's in rehabilitation center. Thank God Almighty. To bring this to a conclusion here. Now, how is my clock doing? Yeah, I got good time. That's good. I got very good time. But what we have is an American empire with three basic pillars. The free market fundamentalism. And all forms of fundamentalism for those who was engaged in Socratic activity. Worthy of deep suspicion. All forms of fundamentalism reduce complexity, create Manichaean views of the world, all good on one side, all evil on the other. The free market fundamentalism says what? The market is a fetish. It has magical powers.
you have a social problem, marketize, privatize, commodify, commercialize, and somehow, some way, things will be all right. Markets are legal constructions created by human beings to be used for good or for ill. There are sick markets like health care. There are highly competitive markets like supermarkets. Free market fundamentalism says what? Privatize even those mechanisms that have to do with satisfying people's most basic needs, like the Bush administration's attempt to privatize Social Security. And that's just one instance among others. So that what happens? Common good, public interest wanes. And the market, that legal construction that requires some non-market values to operate, begins to run amok, becomes more and more unedited, unregulated. And Adam Smith understood so very well, it's no accident he wrote not only The Wealth of Nations, but also A Theory of Moral Sentiments. Both books are very important in understanding their early theorists of the market, because he knew that a contract was predicated on non-contractarian values like trust and loyalty. And when we look at free market fundamentalism run amok, we see Enron, we see World.com, we see corporate elites acting as gangsters. And I use the word gangster because, of course, there's been a lot of debate about gangster rappers. We use that term about them so easily. They ought to be shaming themselves, those gangster rappers talking about all that raw stuff. And you say, no, they're just mirroring what they see in the larger society. They look in corporate America and see gangster activity. Gangster activity can be characterized as those preoccupied with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. Gain access to power, pleasure, property by any means. And of course, in the case of corporate elites, billions and billions and billions of dollars confiscated, embezzled, stolen. And contrast that with the thousands of dollars that welfare mothers stole and embezzled. They get put on the front page and stay there. Corporate elites get a little hit on the wrist. We've got a Corporate Responsibility Act that we were very upset about. We're going to, please. Free market fundamentalism will undermine the very conditions for the possibility of democracy, because democracy is predicated on a vital public life. And you end up with a younger generation that believes, in fact, that the market way of life is the human way of life. To be human is to be stimulated, titillated, rather than nourished, rather than deeply empowered. Believe that buying and selling and promoting and advertising are the fundamental ways of being in the world. Learn how to package yourself. Go to school, high school, and college, not in order to engage in paideia and cultivation of self and soul, but to acquire a skill so you can gain access to some dynamite job and live in some vanilla suburb. What an impoverished way of being in the world.
Cornel West speaking in Santa Fe. Cornel West teaches African American studies and religion at Princeton University, where he is a professor. You are listening to Democracy Now. If you'd like to get a copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Back with Cornel West in a minute. Thank you. John Coltrane here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to Princeton University Professor of Religion and African American Studies, Cornel West, speaking in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in an event sponsored by the Lannan Foundation. This is Cornel West.
Eugene O'Neill said it so well in Iceman Cometh, or at least in his interview prior to the Iceman Cometh in 1946, he said, Americans suffer from this notion that somehow they can possess their souls by means of possessing commodities. Don't they recognize that they'll end up a nation and an empire who has the capacity to conquer the world but has completely lost its soul? Oh, Eugene, we need you, brother. Your insight still ripples down through these 57 years since the Ice Man cometh with the pipe dreams of Hickey and his partners in Harry Hope's saloon, dangling the empty carrots of an empire that on the outside is so powerful, but on the inside is so hollow and shallow when it comes to its spirit and soul. It's no accident Martin Luther King Jr. entitled the theme of the freedom movement, the slogan of the Southern Leadership Christian Conference, what? Saving the soul of America. He didn't have to read Eugene O'Neill's Iceman Cometh to know what he was talking about. And of course, Malcolm X suggested, Brother Martin, America has no soul, brother. You're missing the point. It's about power.
And Martin said, I'm not naive, Malcolm. I know it's very much about power, but a democracy must also be about common good and public life, and I'm a Democrat, small d. And if you play only the game of power, then Thrasymachus is right in Plato's Republic. Might makes right. And I refuse to simply play the game of power, even though I'll bring power to bear with a moral vision. And of course, as Malcolm continued to grow, he said, you know, Martin, I begin to see your point more clearly now. You're absolutely right. Even your language of love makes sense to me. Because it is, in fact, better to fight to save the soul rather than to blind oneself and live a soulless life in an imperial country. A certain way of being in the world. A certain bearing witness, even if you are unable to bring about the kind of changes you want in your generation, somebody will know 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, you bore witness, you tried to speak the truth and expose lies so that you can then bequeath that legacy to them. Tradition is not something you inherit, T.S. Eliot says. You have to fight for it in order to actually gain access to your tradition. You can't keep a tradition of struggle for freedom and democracy alive without people willing to bear witness, even in a bleak moment when they know that they will never see the positive results in their lifetime. That's part of our challenge today. That's part of our challenge, this historical moment. That's one reason why we live in the age of Chekhov. Oh, Anton Chekhov, grandson of a slave, medical doctor, that ministers to the poor during the day and writes short stories and plays at night. And his age was one of what? Deep disillusionment, deep disappointment, deep disenchantment, and yet what? Endurance through suffering, struggle through darkness. Why? Because it's not about just winning. It's about testifying and bearing witness. You get this even in our dominant forms of religiosity in the United States, right? Especially Christianity. American Christianity is a market form of Christianity for the most part. It's all about identifying with a winner. That's why
Easter Sunday, the churches are full, but Good Friday, they're empty. I'll show up when the winner pops up. But don't tell me about the main protagonist being treated like a political prisoner by the Roman Empire. Don't tell me about a senseless death based on injustice. And certainly don't tell me about the Saturday in which, echoing Nietzsche, God is dead, even for Christians. We don't get too much theothanatology in Christian thought these days. But God is dead that Saturday. And there was no thought of a bounce back. That's why Peter himself said, I didn't know the brother three times. Never seen him. No recollection of him. And that's Peter. That's the foundation of the church, right? But to live in the age of Chekhov says what? Yes, we can look at that darkness. We can look at the Patriotic Act 1, the Patriotic Act 2, the escalating authoritarianism, the violation of rights and liberties of Arab brothers and sisters and Muslim brothers and sisters. And if they start there, an Arab American is just as American as any other American in this nation. They start there, it easily creeps. It's easily extended. We can look at the aggressive militarism. Iraq today, Syria, Iran, North Korea tomorrow. It's very dark. Chekhov says what? Keep smiling. Keep fighting. Keep thinking. Keep loving. Keep serving. Keep sacrificing. It's not about the win overnight. It's not about the quick fix. It's not about the push-button solution. It's about what kind of human being you want to be. What kind of legacy you want to live. Reminds one very much of the blues. I've been down so long that down don't worry me no more. That's why I keep keeping on anyway. It's not logical. It's not logical at all. Because if you depend solely on the logic, you're in deep trouble. And that's another reason why I think that a blues people have so much to teach a blues nation, that the doings and sufferings and visions of black people in the Chekhovian manner have much to teach the United States now that as a nation we have the blues. Not just in our economy. Workers have had it for a long time. Not just in our homes, sisters of all colors dealing with domestic violence. Not just in our social life. Gay brothers and lesbian sisters devalued, dealing with the hypocrisy of the straits, the insecurity of the straits. No, now it's a national community. You see, we can all go to friends and receive a common response, right? No matter what color you are, it's, oh my God, I'm more American than I thought. I didn't feel that American in Chicago, but I'm very American in Paris. What's going on here? Yes. Part of a community that is perceived by the world as being arrogant, disrespectful of international law, unwilling to cooperate with other nations, imposing our will on the world. And I don't believe that's going to change. I don't believe that's going to change. You see. And of course, we haven't even begun to talk about Africa and the AIDS epidemic and what role Africa and Latin America can play in possible shapings of a better world in light of their struggles at this particular moment. Latin America has a long history of American imperial treatment. Long history of it, you see. They have much to teach us. But the blues people in the midst of the American empire largely but not exclusively peoples of color have much to teach if they are willing to step forward. The danger here, of course, is what? There's a lot of cowardice in the black community. Afraid to speak. Want to get it on the goodies. Grab the booty of the empire. We're seeing it more and more and more. Black politicians won't mention one word about the prison industrial complex. We have a whole presidential campaign, an election. There's no talk about the connection between the criminal justice system and the prison industrial complex because they've all agreed to be hard on crime. And hard on crime means war of
drugs against poor young people,
disproportionately black and brown. And this goes for those black folk in the Democratic Party. I was just with Brother Jesse 2 days ago at the Rainbow Coalition. I said, Brother Jesse, it's good to see you stepping out, brother. He's getting upset. He was just at Benton Harbor, Michigan. You all know what happened there. Another instance, peak of an iceberg, part of the 112 yearly young black people who are shot down like dogs by police who happen to pull the trigger when their backs are turned. And we think, oh, my God, Rodney King, glad we hadn't heard about that again. Happening all the time. Cincinnati, Benton Harbor, Los Angeles, New York, over and over again. A lot of black leaders don't want to talk about it. People ask me, oh, Brother West, why are you hanging around with Al Sharpton? Al Sharpton needs to get a haircut. Well, I'm concerned about his brain. What's he thinking? His heart, his soul. Got a flawed history? Absolutely. Absolutely. Has he changed? Is he speaking any truths that make sense vis-a-vis other candidates in Democratic primary? I'm just raising questions. I'm not proselytizing him. Just raising questions, you see. But who's going to talk about a criminal justice complex? 2 million fellow Americans in jail, 50% black, 46% of young black men between 16 and 25 in Baltimore, Chicago, part of the criminal justice complex. What does it take in the black community? How many of your children need to be in prison before you get indignant? Unless you think somehow they're genetically inclined, we still got fellow Americans who think that. There'll always be some of those folk around. White supremacy dies very slowly, even on the pseudoscientific front. What happens when it begins to escalate? The fastest group going into prison right now is poor white brothers. I'm just as concerned about them as I am poor black. They're human beings like anybody else. Where's the focus? Or do we have to wait until the criminal justice system begins to expand over Princeton and University of Chicago, Stanford. Oh, you know, we think we got a crisis with our young people at this point. I think we really need to do something serious. Michael Moore showed that so well in his film, Caliban. Black kids, brown kids been shooting each other down for decades. You get one major shootout in white America, everybody stops. Got to be very sensitive here. You know, these are very complex situations. This is got to be nuanced here. These are nice kids. They're like us. They're all American, you know. Oh, I see. Very different approach here, huh? What a situation. What are we to do? End on the blue note. No optimism here. The evidence does not look good. Be a freedom fighter in the 21st century is to make a radical distinction between hope and optimism. One must be a prisoner of hope. Yes. Unconditional commitment to mustering the courage to think critically, speak freely. Unconditional commitment to a
courage to try to keep track of the humanity of each and every person, the courage to love, serve, and sacrifice, and an unconditional commitment to fight for democracy in its substantive form, a rich public life, a pervasive common good with the private sector and its precious rights and liberties protected, yes, but balanced in such a way that it does not suffocate the public forms of expression or community, of what holds us together, what connects us, so that our glue does not become so weak that we end up so polarized that we're at each other's throats, in part because we're not organized and mobilized against those powers that be at the top. How rare it is in American history when significant enough numbers of the citizenry can organize and look upward, confront the powers that be, rather than scapegoat the most vulnerable. That's the easiest thing, you see. And in the end, we're talking about leadership that has a blue note and a blue sensibility. But it's also a leadership that, by example, in being willing to speak, act, write, fuse, share, laugh, love with others, that it can inspire others so it becomes contagious. There's never any guarantee of any victory in history. Never, never been, never will be. But if we can convince each other to become less conformist and less complacent, more Socratic, more prophetic, more radically democratic, we have a chance. And I hope and pray that each one of you, in wrestling with these questions, try to take seriously the Socratic and prophetic and democratic challenge that I've put forward tonight. Thank you all so very much. We have good time for dialogue and sustaining. So,
Professor Cornel West giving a Lannan Foundation lecture in Santa Fe, New Mexico, this past June. Cornel West is professor of African American Studies and Religion at Princeton University, formerly at Harvard University, until he had differences with Harvard University's president. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a video or audio cassette copy, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Our website is democracynow.org. That's www.democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, and Pervez Sharma. Rich Kim and Mike DeFilippo are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening. Thank you.